Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm John Hale, guest hosting this week's haunting Halloween episode. Okay, I love a great spooky tale, and here in Appalachia, we have some really great ones. Today's stories are about things that go boo in the night.
Woo! No!
And we'll hear some tales that are just mysterious and strange.
I believe they saw something. I can't tell you exactly what it was.
And right as the young man rides under these interweaving branches, he hears an unearthly scream. And something jumps onto his back.
We'll hear why the legend of one monster from beyond the stars attracts tourists to West Virginia, some as far as Japan.
Even though it was floating quietly, but also emitting like a shrieking sound.
You'll find these spine-chilling stories and more in this week's episode of Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm John Hale. Okay, so full disclosure here, folks. I'm a big fan of monsters. Whether it's creature features, comics, toys, if it has a monster in it, I'm in. I'm also a fan of some of our own local Appalachian cryptids. Mothman, the Gravity Monster, Sheepsquatch. So when I was asked to participate in this year's Halloween episode, I was pumped. For a few years now, we've had an annual tradition of asking you, our listeners, for your favorite ghost tales and legends. We have a lot of great storytellers here in Appalachia, and we'd love to celebrate that. The legends and stories in today's shows aren't fact-checked or verified, and they aren't meant to be taken too seriously. But to me, I think they do speak to something traditional for us. After all, long before Netflix or Snapchat, our ancestors spent many an evening sitting around the fireplace, spinning tales and telling stories. It's one of the oldest forms of entertainment there is. We'll start with what I think is perhaps one of the weirdest monster stories out there. The Flatwoods Monster has become a part of West Virginia's pop culture over the years. It's even made a larger resurgence just in the past 4 years through a tourism campaign and a new museum. Our Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan brings us the story from Braxton County.
The story of the Flatwoods Monster began September 12, 1952, in the small town of Flatwoods. It was 7 o'clock at night, and some schoolboys were playing football. They saw some kind of object falling from the sky that looked to be on fire, says Andrew Smith. He's somewhat of an expert when it comes to the Flatwoods legend.
Something bright, maybe a fireball, appeared to fly overhead and land on a nearby hilltop.
Andrew's the executive director of the Braxton County Visitor Center, as well as the founder of the Flatwoods Monster Museum, which opened 2 years ago. So, as the original story goes, the boys and two adults hiked up the hill to check out this fireball. There was an overwhelming rotten egg smell in the air that burned their eyes.
They see movement from their left coming from the woods, and as they shine their light at it,
they saw a 10-foot-tall monster hovering above the ground, spewing smoke and gas at them. Its head was red and spade-shaped, with a distinct point at the top. It had glowing eyes with spindly arms and claws. Its body was covered in some kind of green armor.
Even though it was floating quietly, but also emitting like a shrieking sound.
Everyone ran home and reported it to the police. Other than a lingering smell, there wasn't much evidence left behind. So that's the basic story of the Flatwoods Monster. It was 67 years ago, but people are still talking about it. And over the years, the telling of the story has varied. Some people think there was a government conspiracy involved. Other versions mention a dog that died from the gas that poured out of the monster. There's just something about this story that lets the imagination run wild. And of course, the actual look of the monster is constantly changing. So the Flatwoods Monster Museum has become an epicenter of all the different interpretations of the monster. It's in an old pharmacy building in the small downtown of Sutton, West Virginia. The storefront windows advertise the museum in different languages for that international appeal. Originally, it was supposed to be the Braxton County Visitor Center, but what started as one small shelf of Flatwoods Monster paraphernalia turned into an entire museum.
I would say easily over 95% of our traffic is because we're a Flatwoods Monster Museum, not because we're a visitor center.
The museum is one large room. At the entrance, people are greeted by a life-sized Flatwoods Monster costume. The walls are lined with tall shelves displaying many reinterpretations of the monster, like drawings, figurines, lanterns, stickers, t-shirts, and video games. Some look cute and inviting, while others have evil eyes and bulging muscles. At the back of the room is another life-sized Flatwoods monster made out of a green graduation gown, PVC pipe, and a red circular pizza pan. Another one sits on top of a shelf. It's just the head of the monster, but it's much larger than a human head. Its menacing eyes peer down at guests. It has a bony, dark red face, hollowed-out cheekbones, and a grim reaper-like cloak.
I have no idea where that came from.
Andrew says a lot of the collection has been donated by artists and collectors. And the museum has also become a hub for all things spooky in West Virginia. It's a place for people to swap not just Flatwoods monster knowledge, but ghost stories and UFO sightings. Colby White, a Morgantown-based musician, has some merchandise from his band on display. Captain Catfish is a punk band with an Appalachian folk music flair. A lot of their tunes are based on regional folklore, such as Bigfoot, the Yeti, and of course, the Flatwoods Monster.
A phantom of Flatwoods from Moon or from Mars. Maybe from God, not from the stars.
The song is called The Phantom of Flatwoods. It's a traditional West Virginia folk song written at the time of the sighting by a local named Don Lamb. However, Colby arranged the music to it. And he actually has a tattoo of the monster. Most people interpret the tale as scary or evil, but he sees it differently. He thinks the Flatwoods monster was just taking in its surroundings when a group of kids and their mom approached from behind.
Here comes, like, you know, a bunch of kids and, like, you know, this woman, like, shining a flashlight in this dude's eyes or creature's eyes. Next thing he knows, he's getting blinded and he freaks out and starts vibrating and just, like, basically throws up some sort of weird oil on him. So I think they startled him. That's my theory. I think they startled the Flatwoods monster.
The monster surprisingly has a Japanese following that Andrew thinks began in the 60s or 80s. It's featured in some older Japanese video games and also made into figurines. They have an anime cartoon look with bright colors and a large toothy mouth. Andrew has used the Flatwoods monster as a way to try to boost tourism in the area. He even runs online ads in Japanese, which proved to be fruitful. Andrew says a Japanese woman visited the museum last year after seeing the ad.
She had seen this drawing her whole life, but she had no idea it was based in America. She had no idea it was based in West Virginia. But learning that it was, she just did this deep dive into West Virginia.
There are also different names associated with the monster, like the Phantom of Flatwoods, Braxton County Monster, and the Flatwoods Green Monster. Andrew says in a board game, it's referred to as Braxy, with two X's.
Braxy has been a word for maybe 3 years. And how often I hear people using it is pretty amazing. And they use it as if it's old.
There are even handmade wooden chairs painted to look like the monster. All five were built by a local carpenter and are placed throughout Braxton County. They are 10 feet tall with built-in stairs to reach the seat. They look more like a throne. Recently, Andrew also launched a social media campaign using the chairs.
You're actually preserving the history and the memory of the Flatwoods monster. So you're taking these pictures and putting them on the internet.
Andrew says he believes the group saw something that September night in 1952. Whether it was the Flatwoods monster, he says he'll leave it up to the imagination. And Colby, the musician, says a part of him would love to spot the monster in the wild, but he also kind of likes the mystery of it all. The unknown. It gives him something to believe in.
Please tell us why you fly over our trees, the end of the world, or an omen of peace.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Braxton County, West Virginia.
Sight of the phantom was a sight to behold. Green eyes and red face, so the story was told.
Fun fact, the Japanese word for monster is kaiju, which translates into strange creature. So to hear that one of our own strange creatures has a Japanese following shows how far this local Appalachian legend has traveled. We've posted a few different artist renditions of the glowing-eyed, red-caped creature known as the Flatwoods Monster. That's at wvpublic.org. There are some great images in our next Halloween story, too. A young woman in Randolph County sent this to us when we put out a call on social media last year, asking people to send us spooky tales. Like most great ghost tales, it takes place late at night, some years ago.
Hi there, my name is Caroline Hoyle, and I was told this story by a man in Montrose, West Virginia. He recounted it as a story that he had been told as a child about his grandfather. The story begins in the early 1900s on the first cold day in autumn. His grandfather, then a young man, left his wife and children to make a trip into town for supplies. So on horseback, he rode 4 miles to the closest town of Elkins. While he was in town, he stopped for a drink, which landed him coming home much later than he expected. Now, this road was rough then, and it remains that way today. So when he reached the neck of his very own holler, he was very weary. And at the mouth of this holler, where it meets the road, there are these gnarled, ancient trees on each side, and their branches form a kind of canopy over the road. And right as the young man rides under these interweaving branches, he hears an unearthly scream. And something jumps onto his back. The thing is heavy and is sinking 2 sets of long claws into each of his shoulders. The horse thunders up the narrow road, going faster and faster. He struggles to stay on while trying to look over his shoulder to catch a glimpse of the great beast. But when he does, all he can see is a great black mass and 2 giant glowing red eyes. He is drenched in terror, clinging to his horse, when suddenly the road makes a sharp right and the creature flies off of his back and straight up into the air. And before he can even breathe a sigh of relief for escaping this beast, he sees that his entire farmhouse, from floorboard to ceiling, is on fire. And his wife and children are nowhere to be found. And that is where his story ended. So horrified, I asked, what happened? What was it? It must have been Mothman, right? A great beast with glowing red eyes that foretells a tragedy, right? He smirked at me and said, Mothman ain't real. That was a panther. You know, like a spook. And it was then that I realized that he hadn't been trying to tell a ghost story. He was imparting wisdom upon me that had been imparted upon him. It was that the horrors that we face in our own hearts are much more frightening than the Mothman.
Speaking of Mothman, which is probably the most famous monster in Appalachia, did you know that there's a festival in his honor? It's held each year in the Ohio River town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and it draws tourists in by the thousands. Mothman has been a subject of several video games and plenty of conspiracy theories. It's often depicted as a flying moth bird-like monster, always with red glowing eyes. A local museum has hosted a Mothman festival every September since the early 2000s. There's a carnival-type atmosphere, local bands, and a wait for over an hour just to get into the Mothman Museum. And another long line just to get your photo taken beside the shiny silver statue of the imposing cryptid. Reporter Emily Allen attended this year's festival to meet some attendees and learn more about why the legend of the Mothman continues to draw so much curiosity.
In the late 1960s, something strange was unfolding in Point Pleasant, an event that would later inspire several films, books, and a local museum. The Mothman legend began with a series of sightings, which eventually came to an end with the collapse of the Silver Bridge in 1967. More than 40 people died as a result. The tragedy has been incorporated into the legend after some people reported seeing the Mothman before the bridge fell. Some say the Mothman was a result of government experiments. Some say he was the last creature left of an otherwise extinct species. Thousands of people with their own thoughts and understandings of the legend gather every year in Point Pleasant for the Mothman Festival. Here are a few of those voices.
Jeff Walmsley, Museum Director.
Ginny Markham.
My name is Grace Bigelow.
Caleb, C-A-L-E-B, Copley, C-O-P-L-E-Y.
Emily Amuti.
Seth Breedlove, B-R-E-E-D-L-O-V-E. What is the legend?
Well, the legend, as I know it, I was 5 years old when it happened, but November of 1966, you know, you had two young couples seeing what they thought was a large bird at first.
Supposedly, like, back in, like, I think 1967, there was a couple teenagers that went out to the bunker area, and they seen a moth-like figure.
You had over 100 reported sightings after that.
One theory is that he, like, was created because of all the chemicals in the area. Like, it was a mutation of some sort of animal, like maybe a bird that mutated. I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if I believe he exists.
I do, yeah. I believe they saw something. I can't tell you exactly what it was.
I mean, anything's possible.
It's such a big mystery, like, as to what people are actually seeing. That I think it invites a lot of curiosity as far as, like, what might have happened.
Either way, if it's real or not real, I think it's really cool that, like, this big urban legend brings people from all over together, like people from West Virginia. I'm not even from West Virginia, and I'm here, you know? So it's just nice that, like, there's something that can unite people and bring a lot of fun.
That was Emily Amuti. If you would like to check out the festival, it's held every September in the town of Point Pleasant, and the Mothman Museum is open year-round. That story was produced by Emily Allen, who is a Report for America Corps member. Monsters aren't the only thing that draws visitors to Appalachia. Some people come here just to be spooked by tales of supposed hauntings. Ghost stories and haunted places exist all over the country. But some places just seem to be better scenes for ghost stories. Often it's places where real historic events also took place. And that history lingers in ways that invite a good ghost tale or two. Like the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. It's one of the most well-known for its American Civil War history, especially in Harper's Ferry, Jefferson County. The town was the site of John Brown's raid and the Battle of Harper's Ferry. During the Civil War, control of the town changed hands from Union to Confederate at least a dozen times. Harper's Ferry saw so much destruction during the war that many now say it's a town home to ghosts and hauntings. Liz McCormick went on a ghost tour there and brings us this snapshot.
Up a series of steep stone steps, and just beyond a screeching gate, is the entrance to the historic St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church in Harper's Ferry. Built in 1833, it still holds Mass on Sunday and is open for special occasions like Christmas. But at night, and year-round, its courtyard is the meeting place for the ghost tours of Harper's Ferry, said to be the oldest ghost tour in America at nearly 50 years old. On this night, about 50 people have gathered to attend the two-hour tour. There are parents with young children, older couples, and a handful of teenagers. A lot are here from out of town, like Melanie Ray from Baltimore. She says she and her boyfriend were visiting the area and looking for something to do.
I love anything that has anything to do with history, and Harper's Ferry has a lot of, especially, I mean, like, pretty bad history, like a lot of bad things happened.
That history is what makes Harper's Ferry a pretty cool backdrop for spooky tales. And tourists like Melanie are intrigued by that. Not everyone believes in the stories, but some do.
All right, let's gather around. We're going to get started.
Sitting in front of the doors of the historic church is Rick Garland. Rick is a local historian and our tour guide for the evening. He took over the ghost tours of Harper's Ferry 10 years ago. During the day, Rick runs a four-hour historical tour in Harper's Ferry, but at night, he's here, telling tales of hauntings.
Anybody bring a camera? Might be looking to take a picture of a ghost tonight.
Rick is dressed in Civil War era clothing and has a 19th century lantern he carries to guide the group. The Ghost Tours of Harper's Ferry was originally run by a woman named Shirley Daugherty, who started the tour in 1970. She has since passed away. Rick continues Shirley's legacy because her family asked him to and because he loves history. Rick also believes in ghosts, but he has a sense of humor about it.
Is there anybody here who does not believe in ghosts? Let's see those hands. What are you doing here? No, I'm going to grab my lantern and my coat. We're going to head out through the side gate.
With his lantern in hand, Rick takes us around the town, highlighting spots that are known for ghostly sightings. He encourages folks to take photos just in case they might catch something paranormal. At one point, we end up at a three-story stone and brick building, which is now a museum dedicated to the Civil War. Here, Rick describes how in the 1980s, a man and his three children moved into an apartment. But every night, the father heard a crying baby in his bedroom.
A few minutes later, the crying sound started up for a third time. It was louder this time. He's getting very fed up with this, so now he says louder, "I told you you have to shut up." And he said, "The moment I got that out of my mouth, he saw something flash across his bedroom."
But when the father goes to check it out, there's nothing there. Later, the crying starts again, but this time, when the father yells, there's a crashing sound, almost like an explosion of bricks. Rick describes a possible explanation for the haunting. Apparently, a diary was discovered, written by a little girl named Anne, who lived in this building during the Battle of Harper's Ferry in 1862.
Anne continues to write, "When the Confederates are bombing our town, there's a woman upstairs in his house on the top floor with a newborn baby, a little infant in her arms, rocking the baby back and forth."
Rick says the diary entry describes how a cannonball smashed into the house, killing the baby and severely injuring the mother. The crowd is silent. A lot of the ghost stories Rick tells are connected in some way to the Civil War. Yeah. By the end of the tour, many who came out chat with Rick, ask questions, and share photos of what they captured, including one woman, Cindy Rhodes, from Charlotte, North Carolina.
So that might be what they call a vortex. A bright light.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is wild. That's weird. I've never seen anything quite like that before.
Cindy tells me that she and her husband travel all over the country to check out ghost tours like this one. The history, for them, is the biggest draw.
And that's what they're more fun for, you know. I mean, there's a ghost here and there, but they're more fun for the history, I think.
And for some who come out to these tours, like Brandon Schaefer of Baltimore, they like to be scared and to run into something spooky.
I like the haunting stuff, and I always hope to see a ghost, so that's mainly why we came out here.
Being a tour guide is Rick Garland's full-time job. And though he does other historical tours, the ghost tour for him is his favorite.
It's great to see how this affects other people. So if you can entertain them, whether it's with the history part of it or with the ghost tour part of it or the spookies part of it or a joke, The fact is that they want to be entertained. They came out to be entertained. And if you can do that for them, they feel good. You feel good. Everybody has a good time.
Whether you believe in ghosts or not, ghost tours like these allow you to imagine, ponder, and wonder. Especially this time of year, as we approach Halloween, we all seem a little more sensitive to spooky things and to the curiosity of the unknown. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia.
As I'm sure you can tell, we're doing things a little differently this week on Inside Appalachia. We're stepping out of the realm of journalism and into the world of the supernatural.
We aren't going for complete fiction, though. A lot of these stories have their basis in facts that surround the Appalachian Mountains.
We're going to stay with the theme of Civil War hauntings for our next story. Donnie Jones is a Civil War reenactor and has been since he was 13 years old. He visits old battlegrounds in uniform and stages battles. He was participating in a reenactment when he encountered something strange on the front lines.
This story, it takes place at Droop Mountain, West Virginia.
we were doing a tactical battle scenario, and we were sent out as the lead element of the Confederate Army. We were portraying Confederate soldiers of the 36th Virginia, who historically weren't there, but that was our unit. And what we did is we went out as what they call skirmishers, which is where we go out in front of the main army to try to feel out, you know, what the enemy is doing, how many of them there are, where they're located, so we can report back to command what's going on. Well, we hadn't gone very far out into this wooded area, and we saw these people behind not really a hedgerow, but just some brush that had been dropped for a quick shelter. And it was just the right height, maybe 3 or 4 feet high, so all you could see were the tops of their hats, which were obviously Union forage caps, and the tops of their muskets with bayonets fixed. And you could see them talking amongst themselves, looking back and forth, but they never shot at us. So our captain, Dan, at the time, he decides, okay, let's just open up on them, start shooting. So we start firing away, and they just keep looking at us. They never fired back. So the captain says, all right, they must be out of ammunition or something. Let's push them. So we charge the works, and we're screaming, and we're hooping and hollering and giving the rebel yell. And when we get right up to the earthworks, there's nobody there. So we're all a little bit confused, and we're looking around trying to see, did these guys run off to the side? Well, they didn't go behind it because there's a drop-off. We would have seen them go off to the right, so where did these guys go? And we're all really confused, and then we hear off in the distance, boom, 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 and you can hear a fight going off in the distance. So we take off running over hills and through creeks and across brush piles, you know, trying to get to where this sound is coming from. And we must have hiked about 15 minutes or so. And when we finally get to where we're going, there's all the reenactors fighting the tactical scenario. So who were we running into? I have no idea. You know, I've heard that the spirits could get confused if you go out, you know, into a battlefield like that in uniform, and they'll try to engage with people. And you hear stories all through history where things like that have happened, but that's the first time that it ever happened to me.
Thanks to Donnie Jones for sharing his experience on Droop Mountain Battlefield. In a minute, we'll hear more ghost tales from across our region. And we'll visit a wildlife center at night to meet mountain lions, wolves, and owls. Reporter Brittany Patterson was told it wasn't that scary.
Oh, no!
Well, maybe it was a little scary. That's up after a quick break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm John Hill. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Okay, I have a cool story for you guys. About 10 years ago, my first job was a cameraman at a local television station. One of my first stories was covering the property of Lake Shawnee in Mercer County. It was the site of a brutal murder. The story goes that a young settler named Mitchell Clay moved his family, comprised of 14 children, to Mercer County. While out hunting one day, a tribe of Native Americans killed two of his children and kidnapped another, Ezekiel. After Mitchell had desperately searched for his son, he discovered that poor Ezekiel had been burned at the stake. As retribution, Clay, with the help of other settlers, tracked down several Native Americans and killed them. It's said that their spirits still roam the property. Now, I bring this up because although Lake Shawnee is supposedly a hotbed for supernatural activity, I didn't see anything out of the ordinary. But having knowledge of that gruesome event made my mind wonder just a bit if ghosts were real. For the past several years, we've asked our listeners to send in their favorite spooky stories. This next one is set in southern West Virginia. A local historian named Scott Worley reached out. He told us about some bizarre events that reportedly occurred in Raleigh County.
One of my favorite stories has been passed down for probably the last 70 years. And it's a story of the coal camps. And in southern West Virginia here, Raleigh County, there are scores of coal camps and coal towns, and they seem to just go from one to the other to the other. And most of them were connected by a rail spur. And each of the towns had hundreds of miners. And the story that has been passed down is that right after the Second World War, when the towns were booming, came to one of the camps a fellow by the name of Frank Easter. And Mr. Easter went to work in the coal camp in Cranberry. And as we know it, he was a solitary man. He lived in a small single miner shack in Cranberry, very much kept to himself. He did like to come into Beckley, as a lot of the miners did. It was a couple of miles, and you could walk right along the rail track, or maybe even catch the train as it came through. He came there to have diversion, to possibly gamble a little bit, shoot some pool, and drink a little beer at the beer hall. Unhappy life. The only cause. Well, one night, 1947, a train is slowly going through. It's 2 a.m. on the tracks, right outside Beckley. They encounter a form of something burning on the track. The train manages to stop. They extinguish the fire, and upon investigation, they find it was the body of Frank Easter. Nobody knows why he was laying on the track burning. Possibly because he was known to wear a long duster-type coat and wore a slouch hat, and he smoked a long pipe. Possibly something flammable was on his coat at the time, and he had passed out from his diversions downtown and caught himself on fire. Nobody really knows. What they do know is that area where the track crossed the ties stayed black. Snow would not stick to that area, no matter how deep. What's even stranger to the story is they buried Frank Easter in a cemetery up on the hill above the coal camp. His grave, no matter how deep the snow will never stick on his grave. Always melts away. But bring forward into the modern day, that area of the railroad track has been taken up. It's now a very popular walking and biking and hiking trail. But guess what? That same area, snow will never stick in the particular space where Frank Easter burned to death on the tracks. And if you look off to the right, off into the field, you'll see the ties stacked up. Some of them are blackened. Some days when you walk by, you can see a form of a man wearing a long coat with a slouch hat, smoking a pipe, leaning or sitting on those ties. Or you may encounter him walking along the tracks. One night, as I was relating this story on a tour, one of the ladies stopped me and said, "I grew up near that area, and my grandmother used to always tell me, don't go walking those tracks alone, dear, because you might run into Frank Easter." And that's one of my favorite stories from the southern West Virginia coal fields. It's always been told, the ghost of Frank Easter.
Do you ever get goosebumps telling that?
All the time. It's probably out of the 70-some stories that I've collected, it's probably one of the ones that really resonates with me the most, because I walk that track and I'm always glancing over at those railroad ties to just see if maybe I can catch a glimpse of Frank Easter.
That was Southern West Virginia historian Scott Worley telling the tale of Frank Easter to Roxy Todd. Scott hosts a tour in Raleigh County called Haunted Beckley.
May nothing evil cross this door. And may ill fortune never pry about these windows. May the roar and rain go by.
That's Asheville-based singer Sarah Lynch Thomason singing a song called May Nothing Evil Cross This Door. A lot of the stories in today's show have been told and retold in a local community until the story grows, and sometimes it becomes very distorted from the truth. And really, maybe there isn't much harm in a story evolving into a myth, but what about those tales that are connected to real people? That's what happened in our next story. A woman in Marion County, West Virginia, who died in the early 1900s, became a local legend years after her death. She became known as the Mannington Witch, and her grave in the Highland Cemetery has been trespassed on many times over the years.
When we tend to overlook the privacy of people in a burial ground.
That's Raymond Alvarez, a professor at Fairmont State University and a volunteer who has helped to restore the Woodlawn Cemetery in Fairmont. When he learned that the story of the Mannington Witch had attracted so many vandals, he set out to learn the real story.
She passed away, and about a year after she passed away, her family had buried her at a church out in the Western District of Marion County, out near Mannington. Little community church, little graveyard. They waited about a year, and they probably didn't have much money, and they put a very plain marker on her grave, and it wasn't fancy. It had a lot of mistakes on it. For example, it had the wrong year of death, and it wasn't engraved by someone that was highly professional, and I think good intentions went misunderstood. So what you see on this grave is a rendering of supposedly gates of heaven, and a staircase. Well, you can't tell if they go up or down, but it says eternal rest, and it has her name. So over the years, people have said, you know, oh, that woman's a witch. Those, you know, she's going to the gates of hell, and therefore, you know, may she have eternal rest in hell. And, you know, I thought, is that really, who was this woman? So I started to do some genealogy research. The woman's name was Cyrilla Jane Wetzel, Cyrilla, sort of an unusual name. She died on May 30th, 1905.
Alvarez points out that Cyrilla likely attracted a bit of gossip in her community because she died unmarried and childless. And that was pretty uncommon, even taboo for her time. Cyrilla Wetzel was listed as a spinster on every historical document he found about her. That combined with the tombstone that was misinterpreted after her death is probably how the legend grew that she was a witch. Sadly, people have not let her rest in peace.
Over the years, vandals broke the stone, knocked the stones over, and somehow it got turned around. So that's part of the myth today. Well, her grave faces west, all the graves faced east, when actually, you know, that was intentionally done, not by the family, probably occurred, oh, not so many years ago, all right, to perpetuate the myth. But I think what we have here is, when you really look at it, you know, the woman wasn't a witch. I mean, there's no record of any evil doing or anything like that, but it was just how we perpetuate a story in a little country graveyard. You go there at night, there's no lights. And like I said, you know, we're trying to debunk it because the people that do have family members at that cemetery, you know, that's a sign of disrespect. You know, that should be the memorial park. That's a place of rest.
Raymond definitely has a point there. Local ghost stories are a lot of fun, but we have to remember that they can be disrespectful if taken too far. I wouldn't like to think that any of my relatives' tombstones would be vandalized by strangers years after they died. Raymond Alvarez shared one more story with us from Marion County. One I love, as I've got a particular appreciation for monster stories. I actually made a monster film about 2 years ago. It was a short film called The Conduit. It's about a young man who fights monsters from another dimension. It featured everything I loved about those old monster movies. A bombastic score, moody lighting, and practical effects. All of our creatures were giant puppets that brought the feel of the old 80s movies I grew up watching when I was a kid. Raymond Alvarez says when he was growing up in the 1960s, he heard about a monster in his community called the Morgan Monster. Sightings began in the 1920s.
A family that lived, was on the Monongahela River, near Reeseville, up on Morgan's Ridge there. They heard banshee noises, or what they thought were banshees. Banshees. Of course, they were an Irish family, so they would associate with a banshee noise. It was the O'Dell family. And so the men of the family tracked the fields around their house. And what they found, or what they came upon, was some kind of a beast killing a sheep. And they fired at it, but they couldn't find the animal. And only muddy tracks, and of course, the remnants of the poor sheep. Later, about 9 years later, and there was a coal mine up there, a coal miner was taking a shortcut through that ridge, and he was attacked by what he said was a white-haired beast the size of a large dog. Because those two things, beast and dog, that would come down through the year. So again, the stories of the Morgan Ridge Monster continued like through the 1930s. So it worked its way into the folklore of the 40s and 50s. And it was an inspiration, of course, for many pranks. But it was always the legend of the white hairy monster roaming the hillsides of that Route 19 north of Fairmont area.
Again, that was Raymond Alvarez talking about the Morgan Monster. He teaches in the business department at Fairmont State University in Fairmont, West Virginia. And in his spare time, he also researches historical events that surround ghost stories and legends from West Virginia. Oh, and by the way, each year around Halloween, he does a community program in Mannington called Scary West Virginia. A lot of people in today's show have been inspired in some way by a ghost tale or the legend of a monster. Many have taken these stories and made it their own. Our next guest turned a ghost tale he heard into a kind of a poem. John Kincaid, who lives in Putnam County, West Virginia, wrote about an event that happened when he was growing up in Fayette County, West Virginia.
Early one morning, about 4:30, Josiah came knocking home on his door. 'Twas the deadest of knocks in the deadest of night. It woke the whole family. Mom turned on the light. "Who is it?" she called. "It's Josiah, your son." Papa pulled on his pants. Little Annie went with a run. Mom looked at Pop. "How can this be? Josiah's miles away in the military. Why, he won't be home for 2 months or more, so how is he knocking now at our door?" Now when to the door Annie pressed hands and ear, she felt apprehension, a slight twinge of fear. "Is that you, Josiah?" "Yes, Annie, it's me. Now open the door and do it quickly." But when they opened the door, no one was there. Just the chill of the night with light fog in the air. "Mom, Pop," Annie said, with fear in her soul. "Josiah was here, but where did he go?" Later that day, the state trooper came, shook Papa's hand, called him by name. He said, "Jess, I think you better go get your wife." The news that he brought them cut like a knife. Josiah had gotten a short 3-day pass and set out on the road to hurry home fast. But his plans and his life would soon end in a flash when the car he was driving was involved in a crash. And the time that it happened, now folks, this may shock, was the same time that morning when they heard him knock. Yes, early one morning, about 4:30, Josiah came knocking home on his door to say goodbye to his kith and his kin, because he knew they would never see him again.
John Kincaid wrote that piece about what he says is a true story. Annie, the girl in the story, told him about it. By the way, John lives in a home that overlooks Scary Creek, where a Civil War battle took place in 1861. This next story was recommended to us by a man in Charleston named Sean Casey. He told us that there were some stories about an old theater in downtown Charleston, West Virginia, that's supposedly haunted. We reach out to Dan Cady, the managing director of Contemporary Youth Arts Company, which used to be based out of this theater, where some strange sightings are said to have occurred.
Everybody says old theaters are haunted anyway. And I find, I think probably that's true, if for no other reason than it motivates your cast sometimes to get, you know, imaginative, to talk about ghost stories in old theaters and invent things. And then people run around and they talk about the theater, and then they talk about the shows that you're doing. And so you get some publicity out of it too. And it's a win-win situation. But there's some pretty frightening things. There were some pretty frightening moments over at the Capitol Plaza, I got to tell you. There really were. The old thing about things going bump in the night, they pretty well went bump in the night every once in a while over there. It was pretty bad.
Do you ever hear any stories about where these bumps may have come from?
Yeah. it's not really stories. I've had kids in my cast look up in the balcony and see people sitting there. Mostly there's a little girl that runs across the balcony up there. That one's pretty friendly. There's a really nasty thing on stage, and I have more than one. I've had some really lousy experiences, bad experiences with that one, as has a lot of different adults in my cast. It's pretty spooky. It is really pretty spooky. And, you know, there's a church in there now, and I wish them well, because I think probably a church might, you know, send all these people to rest. But when I left, it was pretty active. It really was. You could sit up in the balcony on most days. You could sit up in the balcony and you would be able to hear old-timey music being played up behind you in the old apartments. That was pretty cool. And you could do that anytime. If we were still there, I could have taken you up there today and you would have heard it. I don't know how you explain that.
Was anybody ever hurt or anything like that, or just spooks?
No, one of the guys that was running the place, he was hired to watch over the place while people doing shows were there, and there were classes up there, so we had a guy. Back about 10 years ago was chased out of the place by I don't know what it was, but it really scared the daylights out of him. It really did, because he literally went running into the night. There were some terrible, but it's a terrible place at times. 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't just hear footsteps, but you can feel the footsteps on the stage. It's really pretty present.
And as somebody who, you know, works on the stage, who creates stories, what is it about spooky stories that keeps people telling them year after year?
I think it's a folktale kind of thing. I think that there are moments in all of these stories that have happened to an awful lot of people that people relate to, even if it's just deja vu, or it's seeing something out of the corner of your eye that when you look it isn't there anymore, but you can't explain what you saw. Those are universal experiences, and so to incorporate them into a story and be able to retell that story makes those stories very attractive and very relatable. And they're fun. You know, it's fun to get scared. Otherwise, the scary movie industry wouldn't be around. So, yeah, you know, Stephen King can write some good stuff because we all relate to those things. You know, we all get scared at one time or another in the dark. We hear noises we can't explain. We see lights we can't explain. And so it's fun to talk about.
Are there any ghost stories you recall from growing up that, I don't know, you heard from your parents or your grandparents that stuck with you, or were you guys a ghost telling family?
No, we were definitely not a ghost telling family. No, we didn't tell those stories. No, and that's a long, long story. But no, I was never terribly captivated. They always scared the daylights out of me. So when you know you get thrust into the situations where these things you know happen to you, gets a little creepy. Yeah.
That was Dan Cady, a playwright in Charleston, West Virginia. The theater company he manages, Contemporary Youth Arts Company, no longer performs out of the Capitol Theater. they've since relocated to a playhouse in the west side of Charleston. When I was younger, I loved to go to local Halloween haunts and get my adrenaline pumping. The thought of some bloody figure wielding a chainsaw really got my blood flowing. That was then. Now, I spend my Halloween with my 2-year-old son, finding ways that he can enjoy the season. He's a big fan of Godzilla, so I thought, naturally, he'd be drawn to little monsters. But no, he's attracted to pumpkins. Not jack-o'-lanterns, but just plain, normal pumpkins. The least scariest aspect of Halloween. Love that kid. While Halloween is often synonymous with scary, for this next story, we sent one reporter who is a self-proclaimed scaredy cat to a Halloween-themed event, light on the scares, but heavy on the spooky creatures. Brittany Patterson reports from the West Virginia State Wildlife Center in Upshur County.
It's the Friday before Halloween, and the parking lot of the West Virginia State Wildlife Center is packed. Hundreds of children and their families have come to the state-run Zoological Center, which houses wildlife, native and introduced to West Virginia, for the 9th annual Spooky Night Tours. I'm here because I love Halloween. Costumes, witches, candy, I love it all. But I hate, and I mean really hate, being scared. And that makes the Spooky Night Tours a good choice for me.
We're just spooky. We're not... We don't do anything really bloody or gory or anything like that.
Judy Channel is the secretary for the State Wildlife Center and organizer of the event.
We are honored to provide a family-friendly Halloween event.
The idea was developed by a former wildlife biologist.
The initial premise was the animals are nocturnal and they're actually kind of more active. And so it was just going to be interesting to walk through the woods with a mountain lion and wolves and black bears and everything. And we just built on it every year.
For the cost of admission, $4 for adults and $2 for kids, visitors can partake in all of the Spooky Night Tours events. That includes taking a hayride through the Wildlife Center. A tractor pulls an open-air trailer with straw bales in the back. It provides a prime view of both the center's creatures and spooky decorations.
Dead bear! Oh my gosh, there's somebody there!
To our right, a mannequin of a park ranger stuck in a manhole.
Maybe the bear got it.
Make-believe objects merge with the real-life animal residents who live here at the Wildlife Center. Up ahead, 3 black bears amble into view. Visitors to the center's Spooky Night Tours can also enter a maze, if they dare. I asked one excited patron, 9-year-old Jaden Straley Smith, what to expect.
Should I be scared?
No!
No, not too scary?
No, not scary at all.
Outside, a cobweb-covered headstone warns visitors, enter at your own risk. All right, here we go into the maze. Inside the tarp-covered maze, spooky skeletons hang from the walls, and orange fairy lights cast a ghoulish glow. The kids seem to love it. As promised, not too scary. Adrian Tucker and her family live about 20 minutes away. They love that the Spooky Night Tour isn't horror-focused.
It's just good, simple fun. Not too scary.
The highlight of the center's Halloween-themed festivities really begins when the sun goes down. This is 9-year-old Brazen Rhodes' 3rd year attending the Spooky Night Tours. This year, he's come prepared.
So tell me about these tools that you have.
Flashlights. I'm gonna shine them in the witch's eyes if they try to jump out at me.
As night falls, excitement mounts. And we're off to see the animals in the dark. The trail has been decorated with different spooky motifs, mostly funny, including a graveyard and a giant dancing spider. One volunteer actor is dressed as a fortune teller.
You will be very tired when you get to the end of the trail.
But the highlight are the animals.
Oh God, there's animals up here! Yes.
The kids are especially impressed by 3 mountain lions, one of which is standing right up against the chain link fence. The kids stalk past the huge cats, waving their glow sticks and flashlights.
I just heard a witch.
Next, we come to a stage scene, which is supposed to be Area 51. A crashed UFO is shrouded in green glowing light. To keep the scare factor low, the actors are kids. 11-year-old Gavin Marsh is dressed head to toe in white plastic. He's playing a hazmat worker on cleanup duty.
One of his brothers is dressed in a suit. He's playing a government worker. Another brother is dressed as an invisible alien. Even though he's really in plain sight, we're supposed to imagine the government workers can't see him.
How's it going out here?
Great.
Great?
Yeah. Just a little bit hard.
A little bit hard?
We gotta act like we don't see him. We're just staring at little strings tied to a tree.
In the darkness and the glowing shadows, their sense of imagination is a little contagious. As we walk on, I feel the spooky settling into my bones. And while none of the actors jump out or grab people, that doesn't mean that some of them aren't a little creepy.
Oh, no!
During one particularly dark stretch of trail, one actor, face painted white like an evil clown, clicks on his flashlight and says, "Boo."
Scaring the crap out of him.
Oh God, you're so scary.
At the end of the tour, I meet up with Brazen Rhodes and his family. Turns out Brazen also fell victim to the scary clown guy.
Was there anything that was scary?
Tell the truth, because it was. There
Except
was a few parts.
That one guy that jumped out.
Yeah. But besides that, did you have fun?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trip organizer Crystal Bevins was impressed.
Very exciting. Very good. Very, very nice decorations. Yes. We had a good time as always. As always. It's very worth a trip to come to it if you've never been.
As for me, well, I survived. And I had a good time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Brittany Patterson at the West Virginia State Wildlife Center.
This Halloween episode has been filled with spooky stories that thrilled, entertained, and hopefully educated you. We all know as rational adults there's always an explanation for the supernatural. Yet, we still have questions. There are television shows dedicated to finding out what goes bump in the night. We sometimes engage in conspiracy theories to find out the answers to things that we can't easily explain. Yet, we persist. Why is that? The capacity for us to find explanations in the seemingly unexplainable is an inherent human trait. And sometimes, to find the answers, our imagination fills in the blanks. I mean, we all know there's no such thing as monsters, right? Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey through Appalachia. Original music in this week's episode was provided by our multi-talented news director and executive producer, Jesse Wright. Our theme music is by Mac Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Sarah Lynch Thomason, and Colby White. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Dave Minsich edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Hale. Jessica Lilly will be back next week. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.